It was 3:45 by the time Ralph crossed the street and walked the short distance back up the hill to his own building. Weariness was stealing over him again. He felt as if he'd been up for roughly 3 centuries. Yet at the same time, he felt better than he had since Carolyn had died. More together, more himself. Or is that maybe just what you want to believe? That a person can't feel this miserable without some sort of positive payback? It's a lovely idea, Ralph, but not very realistic. All right, he thought. So maybe I'm a little confused right now. Indeed he was. Also frightened, exhilarated, disoriented, and a touch horny. Yet one clear idea came through this mix of emotions. One thing he needed to do before he did anything else. He had to make up with Bill. If that meant apologizing, he could do that. Maybe an apology was even in order. Bill, after all, hadn't come to him saying, "Gee, old buddy, you look terrible, tell me all about it." No, he had gone to Bill. He had done so with misgivings, true, but that didn't change the fact, and... Ah, Ralph, geez, what am I going to do with you? It was Carolyn's amused voice, speaking to him clearly as it had during the weeks following her death, when he'd handled the worst of his grief by discussing everything with her inside his head, and sometimes aloud if he happened to be alone in the apartment. Bill was the one who blew his top, sweetie, not you. I see you're just as determined to be hard on yourself now as you were when I was alive. I guess some things never change. Ralph smiled a little. Yeah, okay, maybe some things never did change. And maybe the argument had been more Bill's fault than his. The question was whether or not he wanted to cut himself off from Bill's companionship over a stupid quarrel and a lot of stiff-necked horseshit about who had been right and who had been wrong. Ralph didn't think he did. And if that meant making an apology Bill didn't really deserve, what was so awful about that? So far as he knew, there were no bones in the 3 little syllables that made up, "I'm sorry." The Carolyn inside his head responded to this idea with wordless incredulity. "Never mind," he told her as he started up the walk. "I'm doing this for me, not for him. Or for you, as far as that goes." He was amazed and amused to discover how guilty that last thought made him feel, almost as if he had committed an act of sacrilege. But that didn't make the thought any less true. He was feeling around in his pocket for his latchkey when he saw a note thumbtacked to the door. Ralph felt for his glasses, but he had left them upstairs on the kitchen table. He leaned back, squinting to read Bill's scrawling hand. "Dear Ralph, Lois, Fay, whoever, I expect to be spending most of the day at Derry Home. Bob Paulhurst's niece called and told me that this time it's almost certainly the real thing. The poor man has almost finished his struggle. Room 313 in Derry Home ICU is about the last place on earth I want to be on a beautiful day in October. But I guess I'd better see this through to the end. Ralph, I'm sorry I gave you such a hard time this morning. You came to me for help, and I damn near clawed your face off instead. All I can say by way of apology is that this thing with Bob has completely wrecked my nerves. Okay? I think I owe you a dinner, if you still want to eat with the likes of me, that is. Fay, please, 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 quit bugging me about your damn chess tournament. I promised I'd play, and I keep my promises. Goodbye, cruel world. Bill." Ralph straightened up with a feeling of relief and gratitude. If only everything else that had been happening to him lately could straighten itself out as easily as this part had done. He went upstairs, shook the tea kettle, and was filling it at the sink when the telephone rang. It was John Lydecker. "Boy, I'm glad I finally got hold of you," he said. "I was getting a little worried, old buddy." "Why?" Ralph asked. "What's wrong?" "Maybe nothing. Maybe something. Charlie Pickering made bail after all."
"You told me that wouldn't happen."
"I was wrong, okay," Lydecker said, clearly irritated. "It wasn't the only thing I was wrong about either.
I told you the judge had probably set bail in the $40,000 range. But I didn't know Pickering was going to draw Judge Stedman, who has been known to say that he doesn't even believe in insanity. Stedman set bail at $80,000. Pickering's court-appointed bellowed like a calf in the moonlight, but it didn't make any difference. Ralph looked down and saw he was still holding the tea kettle in one hand. He put it on the table. And he still made bail? Yep. Remember me telling you that Ed would throw him away like a paring knife with a broken blade? Yes. Well, score it as another strikeout for John Lydecker. Ed marched into the bailiff's office at 11 o'clock this morning with a briefcase full of money. $8,000? Ralph asked. I said briefcase, not envelope, Lydecker replied. Not eight, but 80. They're still buzzing down at the courthouse. Hell, they'll be buzzing about it even after the Christmas tinsel comes down. Ralph tried to imagine Ed Deepnow in one of his baggy old sweaters and a pair of worn corduroys. Ed's mad scientist outfits, Carolyn had called them, pulling banded stacks of 20s and 50s out of his briefcase and couldn't do it. I thought you said 10% was enough to get out. It is if it can also escrow something. A house or a piece of property, for instance, that stacks up somewhere near the total bail amount. Apparently Ed couldn't do that, but he did have a little rainy day cash under the mattress. Either that or he gave the tooth fairy one hell of a blowjob. Ralph found himself remembering the letter he had gotten from Helen about a week after she had left the hospital and moved out to High Ridge. She had mentioned a check she had gotten from Ed, $750. It seems to indicate he understands his responsibilities, she had written. Ralph wondered if Helen would still feel that way if she knew that Ed had walked into the Derry County Courthouse with enough money to send his daughter sailing through the first 15 years of her life and pledged it to free a crazy guy who liked to play with knives and Molotov cocktails. Where in God's name did he get it? He asked Lydecker. Don't know. And he isn't required to say? Nope. It's a free country. I understand he said something about cashing in some stocks. Ralph thought back to the old days. The good old days before Carolyn had gotten sick and died, and Ed had just gotten sick. Thought back to meals the four of them had had together once every 2 weeks or so. Take out pizza at the Deep Nose, or maybe Carol's chicken pot pie in the Roberts' kitchen. And remembered Ed saying on one occasion that he was going to treat them all to prime rib at the Red Lion in Bangor when his stock accounts matured. That's right, Helen had replied, smiling at Ed fondly. She'd been pregnant then, just beginning to show, and looking all of 14 with her hair pulled back in a ponytail and wearing a checkered smock that was still yards too big for her. Which do you think will mature first, Edward? The 2,000 shares of United Toe Jam or the 6,000 of Amalgamated Sour Balls? And he'd growled at her, a growl that had made them all laugh, because Ed Deepnow didn't have a mean bone in his body. Anyone who had known him more than 2 weeks knew that Ed wouldn't hurt a fly. Except Helen might have known a little different. Even back then, Helen had almost surely known a little different. Fond look or no fond look. Ralph? Lydecker asked. Are you still there? Ed didn't have any stocks, Ralph said. He was a research chemist, for Christ's sake, and his father was foreman in a bottling plant in some crazy place like Plaster Rock, Pennsylvania. No dough there. Well, he got it somewhere, and I'd be lying if I said I liked it. From the other friends of life, do you think? No, I don't. First, we're not talking rich folks here. Most of the people who belong to the Friends are blue-collar types, working-class heroes. They give what they can, but this much? No. They could have gotten together enough property deeds among them to spring Pickering, I suppose, but they didn't. Most of them wouldn't even if Ed had asked. Ed's all but persona non grata with them now, and I imagine they wish they'd never heard of Charlie Pickering. Dan Dalton's taken back the leadership of the Friends of Life, and to most of them, that's a big relief. Ed and Charlie and two other people, a man named Frank Felton and a woman named Sandra McKay, seem to be operating very much on their own hook now. Felton, I don't know anything about, and there's no jacket on him, But the McKay woman has toured some of the same fine institutions as Charlie. She's unmissable, too. Pasty complexion, lots of acne, glasses so thick they make her eyes look like poached eggs. Goes about 300 pounds.
You joking?
No. She favors stretch pants from Kmart and can usually be observed traveling in the company of assorted ding-dongs, funny bones, and hostess Twinkies. She often wears a big sweatshirt with the words Baby Factory on the front. Claims to have given birth to 15 children. She's never actually had any, and probably can't.
Why are you telling me all this?
Because I want you to watch out for these people, Lydecker said. He spoke patiently, as if to a child. They may be dangerous. Charlie is, for sure. That you know without me telling you. And Charlie is out. Where Ed got the money to spring him is secondary. He got it. That's what matters. I wouldn't be a bit surprised if he came after you again. Him or Ed or the others.
What about Helen and Natalie?
They're with their friends. Friends who are very hip to the dangers posed by screw-loose hubbies. I filled Mike Hanlon in, and he'll also keep an eye on her. The library is being watched very closely by our men. We don't think Helen's in any real danger at the present time. She's still staying at High Ridge, but we're doing what we can.
Thank you, John. I appreciate that. And I appreciate the call.
I appreciate that you appreciate it, but I'm not quite done yet. You need to remember who Ed called and threatened, my friend. Not Helen, but you. She doesn't seem to be much of a concern to him anymore, but you linger on his mind, Ralph. I asked Chief Johnson if I could assign a man. Chris Nell would be my pick, to keep an eye on you. At least until after Woman Care's rent-a-bitch has come and gone. I was turned down. Too much going on this week, he said. But the way I was turned down suggests to me that if you asked, you'd get someone to watch your back.
So what do you say?
Police protection, Ralph thought. That's what they call it on the TV cop shows. And that's what he's talking about. Police protection. He tried to consider the idea, but too many other things got in the way. They danced in his head like weird sugar plums. Hats, ducks, smocks, spray cans, not to mention knives, scalpels, and a pair of scissors glimpsed in the dusty lenses of his old binoculars. Each thing I do, I rush through so I can do something else, Ralph thought. And on the heels of that, it's a long walk back to Eden, sweetheart, so don't sweat the small stuff.
No, he said.
What? Ralph closed his eyes and saw himself picking up this same phone and calling to cancel his appointment with a pin sticker man. This was the same thing all over again, wasn't it? Yes, he could get police protection from the Pickerings and the McKays and the Feltons, but that wasn't the way this was supposed to go. He knew that, felt it in every beat of his heart and pulse of his blood.
You heard me, he said. I don't want police protection.
For God's sake, why?
I can take care of myself, Ralph said, and grimaced a little at the pompous absurdity of this sentiment, which he had heard expressed in John Wayne Weston's Without Number.
Ralph, I hate to be the one to break the news to you, but you're old. You got lucky on Sunday. You might not get lucky again.
I didn't just get lucky, Ralph thought. I've got friends in high places. Or maybe I should say entities in high places.
I'll be okay, he said. Lydecker sighed. If you change your mind, will you call me?
Yes.
And if you see either Pickering or a large lady with thick glasses and stringy blonde hair hanging around, I'll call you.
Ralph, please think this over. Just a guy parked down the street is all I'm talking about.
Done bun can't be undone, Ralph said.
Huh?
I said I appreciate it, but no. I'll be talking to you.
Ralph gently replaced the telephone in its cradle. Probably John was right, he thought. Probably he was crazy. Yet he had never felt so completely sane in his life.
Tired, he told his sunny, empty kitchen, but sane. He paused, then added, also halfway to being in love, maybe.
That made him grin, and he was still grinning when he finally put the kettle on to heat.
He was on his second cup of tea when he remembered what Bill had said in his note about owing him a meal. He decided on the spur of the moment to ask Bill to meet him at daybreak sundown for a little supper. They could start over. "I think we have to start over," he thought, "because that little psycho has got his hat, and I'm pretty sure that means he's in trouble." Well, no time like the present. He picked up the phone and dialed a number he had no trouble remembering. 941-5000. The number of Derry Home Hospital. The hospital receptionist connected him with room 313. The clearly tired woman who answered the phone was Denise Paulhurst, the dying man's niece. "Bill wasn't there," she told him. "Four other teachers from what she termed Unc's Glory Days had shown up around one, and Bill had proposed lunch. Ralph even knew how his downstairs tenant would have put it. Better belated than never. It was one of his favorites." When Ralph asked her if she expected him back soon, Denise Paulhurst said she did. "He's been so faithful. I don't know what I would have done without him, Mr. Robbins." "Roberts," he said. "Bill made Mr. Paulhurst sound like a wonderful man." "Yes, they all feel that way. But of course the Bills won't be coming back to his fan club, will they?" "No," Ralph said uncomfortably. "I suppose not. Bill's note said your uncle is very low." "Yes. The doctor says he probably won't last the day, let alone the night. But I've heard that song before. God forgive me, but sometimes it's like Uncle Bob's one of those ads from Publishers Clearing House. Always promising, never delivering. I suppose that sounds awful, but I'm too tired to care. They turned off the life support stuff this morning. I couldn't have taken the responsibility all by myself, but I called Bill, and he said it was what Unc would have wanted. It's time for Bob to explore the next world, he said. He's mapped this one to a nicety. Isn't that poetic, Mr. Robbins?" "Yes. It's Roberts, Miss Paulhurst. Will you tell Bill that Ralph Roberts called and would like him to call back?" So we turned it off, and I was all prepared, nerved up, I guess you'd say. And then he didn't die. I can't understand it. He's ready. I'm ready. His life's work is done. So why won't he die? I don't know. Death is very stupid, she said, speaking in the nagging and unlovely voice which only the very tired and the deeply heartsick seem to employ. An obstetrician this slow in cutting a baby's umbilical cord would be fired for malpractice. Ralph's mind had a tendency to drift these days, but this time it snapped back in a hurry. "What did you say?" "Beg your pardon." She sounded startled, as if her own mind had been drifting. "You said something about cutting the cord." "I didn't mean anything," she said. That nagging tone had grown stronger. Except it wasn't nagging, Ralph realized. It was whining, and it was frightened. Something was wrong here. His heartbeat suddenly speeded up. "I didn't mean anything at all," she insisted. And suddenly the phone Ralph was holding turned a deep and sinister shade of blue in his hand. She's been thinking about killing him, and not just idly either. She's been thinking about putting a pillow over his face and smothering him with it. It wouldn't take long, she thinks. A mercy, she thinks. Over at last, she thinks. Ralph pulled the phone away from his ear. Blue light, cold as a February sky, rose in pencil-thin rays from the holes in the earpiece. Murder is blue, Ralph thought, holding the phone at arm's length and staring with wide-eyed unbelief as the blue rays began to bend and drip toward the floor. He could hear very faintly the quacking, anxious voice of Denise Paulhurst. "It wasn't anything I ever wanted to know, but I guess I know it anyway. Murder is blue." He brought the handset toward his mouth again, cocking it to keep the top half with its freight of icicle aura away from him. He was afraid that if that end of the handset got too close to his ear, it might deafen him with her cold and furious desperation. "Tell Bill that Ralph called," he said. "Roberts, not Robbins." He hung up without waiting for a reply. The blue rays shattered away from the phone's earpiece and tumbled toward the floor. Ralph was again reminded of icicles.
This time, of how they fell in a neat row when you ran your gloved hand along the underside of an eave after a warm winter day. They disappeared before they hit the linoleum. He glanced around. Nothing in the room glowed, shimmered, or vibrated. The auras were gone again. He began to let out a sigh of relief, and then, from outside on Harris Avenue, a car backfired. In the empty second-floor apartment, Ralph Roberts screamed.
He didn't want any more tea, but he was still thirsty. He found half a Diet Pepsi, flat but wet, in the back of the fridge, poured it into a plastic cup with a faded red Apple logo on it, and took it outside. He could no longer stand to be in the apartment, which seemed to smell of unhappy wakefulness, especially not after what had happened with the phone. The day had become even more beautiful, if that was possible. A strong, mild wind had developed, rolling bands of light and shadow across the west side of Derry, and combing the leaves from the trees. These the wind sent hurrying along the sidewalks in rattling dervishes of orange and yellow and red. Ralph turned left, not because he had any conscious desire to revisit the picnic area up by the airport, but only because he wanted the wind at his back. Nevertheless, he found himself entering the little clearing again some 10 minutes later. This time it was empty, and he wasn't surprised. There was no edge in the wind that had sprung up, nothing to make old men and women scurry indoors. But it was hard work keeping cards on the table or chess pieces on the board when the puckish wind kept trying to snatch them away. As Ralph approached the small trestle table where Faye Chapin usually held court, he was not exactly surprised to see a note held down by a rock, and he had a good idea of what the subject would be even before he put down his plastic red apple cup and picked it up. Two walks, two sightings of the bald doc with a scalpel, two old people suffering insomnia and seeing brightly colored visions, two notes. It's like Noah leading the animals onto the ark, not one by one, but in pairs. And is another hard rain going to fall? Well, what do you think, old man? He didn't know what he thought, but Bill's note had been a kind of obituary in progress, and he had absolutely no doubt that Faye's was the same thing. That sense of being carried forward, effortlessly and without hesitation, was simply too strong to doubt. It was like awakening on some alien stage to find oneself speaking lines, or stumbling through them anyway, in a drama for which one could not remember having rehearsed, or seeing a coherent shape in what had up until then looked like complete nonsense, or discovering what? Another secret city, that's what, he murmured. The Derry of Auras. Then he bent over Faye's note and read it while the wind played prankishly with his thinning hair. Those of you who want to pay your final respects to Jimmy Vandermeer are advised to do so by tomorrow at the very latest. Father Coughlin came by this noon and told me the poor old guy is sinking fast. He can have visitors, though. He is in Derry Home ICU, room 315. Faye. P.S. Remember that time is short. Ralph read the note twice, put it back on the table with the rock on top to weight it down for the next old crock to happen along, then simply stood there with his hands in his pockets and his head down, gazing out at runway 3 from beneath the bushy tangle of his brows. A crisp leaf, orange as one of the Halloween pumpkins which would soon decorate the street, came flipping down from the deep blue sky and landed in his sparse hair. Ralph brushed it away absently, and thought of two hospital rooms on Holmes' ICU floor. Two rooms side by side. Bob Paulhurst in one, Jimmy V in the other. And the next room up the hall? That one was 317, the room in which his wife had died. This is not a coincidence, he said softly. But what was it? Shapes in the mist? A secret city? Evocative phrases, both of them. But they answered no questions. Ralph sat on top of the picnic table next to the one upon which Faye had left his note, took off his shoes and crossed his legs. The wind gusted, ruffling his hair. He sat there amid the falling leaves with his head slightly bent and his brow furrowed in thought. He looked like a Winslow Homer version of Buddha as he meditated with his hands cupping his kneecaps, carefully reviewing his impressions of Dock Number 1 and Dock Number 2, and then contrasting these impressions with those he'd gotten of Dock Number 3. First impression. All three docks had reminded him of the aliens in tabloids like Inside View and pictures which were always labeled artists' conceptions. Ralph knew that these bald-headed, dark-eyed images of mysterious visitors from space went back a good many years. People had been reporting contacts with short baldies, the so-called little doctors, for a long time, maybe for as long as people had been reporting UFOs. He was quite sure that he had read at least one such account way back in the 60s. Okay, so say there are quite a few of these fellows around, Ralph told a sparrow which had just lit on the picnic area's litter barrel. Not just three docks, but 300 or 3,000. Lois and I aren't the only ones who've seen them, and didn't most of the people who gave accounts of such meetings also mention sharp objects? Yes, but not scissors or scalpels. At least Ralph didn't think so. Most of the people who claimed to have been abducted by the little bald doctors talked about probes, didn't they? The sparrow flew off. Ralph didn't notice. He was thinking about the little bald docs who had visited May Locker on the night of her death. What else did he know of them? What else had he seen? They'd been dressed in white smocks, like the ones worn by TV show doctors in the 50s and 60s, like the ones pharmacists still wore. Only their smocks, unlike the one worn by Doc Number 3, had been clean. Number 3 had been toting a rusty scalpel. If there'd been any rust on the scissors Doc Number 1 had been holding in his right hand, Ralph hadn't noticed it, not even after he'd trained the binoculars on them. Something else, probably not important, but at least you noticed it. Scissors toting Doc was right-handed, at least judging from the way he held his weapon. Scalpel-wielding Doc is a southpaw. No, probably not important, but something about it. Another of those shapes in the mist, this a small one, tugged at him just the same. Something about the dichotomy of left and right. Go to the left and you'll be right, Ralph muttered, repeating the punchline of some joke he no longer even remembered. Go to the right and you'll be left. Never mind. What else did he know about the docks? Well, they'd been surrounded by auras, of course, rather lovely greenish-gold ones. And they had left those white man tracks, Arthur Murray dance diagrams behind them. And although their features had struck him as perfectly anonymous, their auras had conveyed feelings of power and sobriety and dignity, goddammit, Ralph said. The wind gusted again and more leaves blew down from the trees. Some 50 yards from the picnic area, not far from the old train tracks, a twisted, half-uprooted tree seemed to reach in Ralph's direction, stretching branches that actually did look a little like clutching hands. It suddenly occurred to Ralph that he had seen quite a lot that night for an old guy who was supposed to be living on the edge of the last age of man, the one Shakespeare and Bill McGovern called the slippered pantaloon. And none of it, not one single thing, suggested danger or evil intent. That Ralph had inferred evil intent wasn't very surprising. They were physically freakish strangers. He had observed them coming out of a sick woman's house at a time of night when visitors seldom, if ever, called. He'd seen them only minutes after waking from a nightmare of epic proportions. Now, however, recollecting what he had seen, other things recurred. The way they had stood on Mrs. Locker's stoop, for instance, as if they had every right to be there. The sense he had gotten of two old friends indulging themselves in a bit of conversation before going on their way. Two old buddies talking it over one more time before heading home after a long night's work. That was your impression, yes. But that doesn't mean you can trust it, Ralph. But Ralph thought he could trust it. Old friends, long-time colleagues, done for the night. May Lockers had been their last stop. All right, so docks number 1 and number 2 were as different from the third one as day is from night. They were clean while he was dirty. They were invested with auras while he had none. None that Ralph had seen, at least. They carried scissors while he carried a scalpel. They seemed as sane and sober as a couple of respected village elders, while number three seemed as crazy as a shithouse rat. One thing is perfectly clear, though, isn't it? Your playmates are supernatural beings, and other than Lois, the only person who seems to know they're there is Ed Deepnow. Want to bet on how much sleep Ed is getting just lately? No, Ralph said. He raised his hands from his knees and held them in front of his eyes. They were shaking a little. Ed had mentioned bald docks, and there were bald docks. Was it the docks he'd been talking about when he talked about centurions? Ralph didn't know. He almost hoped so, because that word, centurions, had begun to call up a much more terrible image in his mind each time it occurred to him. The ringwraiths from Tolkien's fantasy trilogy. Hooded figures astride skeletal red-eyed horses, bearing down on a small party of cowering hobbits outside the Prancing Pony Tavern in Bree. Thinking of hobbits made him think of Lois, and the trembling in his hands grew worse. Carolyn, it's a long walk back to Eden, sweetheart, so don't sweat the small stuff. Lois, in my family, dying at 80 is dying young. Joe Weiser, the medical examiner usually ends up writing suicide on the cause of death line rather than insomnia. Bill, his specialty was the Civil War, and now he doesn't even know what a Civil War is, let alone who won ours. Denise Paulhurst, death is very stupid. An obstetrician this slow in cutting a baby's umbilical cord. It was as if someone had suddenly clicked on a bright searchlight inside his head. And Ralph cried out into the sunny autumn afternoon. Not even the Delta 727 settling in for a landing on runway 3 could entirely drown that cry. He spent the rest of the afternoon sitting on the porch of the house he shared with McGovern, waiting impatiently for Lois to come back from her card game. He could have tried McGovern again at the hospital, but didn't. The need to speak to McGovern had passed. Ralph didn't understand everything yet, but he thought he understood a great deal more than he had. And if his sudden flash of insight at the picnic area had any validity at all, telling McGovern what had happened to his Panama would serve absolutely no purpose, even if Bill believed him. I have to get the hat back, Ralph thought, and I have to get Lois's earrings back, too. It was an amazing late afternoon and early evening. On the one hand, nothing happened. On the other hand, everything happened. The world of auras came and went around him like the stately progression of cloud shadows across the west side. Ralph sat and watched, rapt, breaking off only to eat a little and make a trip to the bathroom. He saw old Mrs. Bennigan standing on her front porch in her bright red coat, clutching her walker and taking inventory of her fall flowers. He saw the aura surrounding her, the scrubbed and healthy pink of a freshly bathed infant, and hoped Mrs. B. didn't have a lot of relatives waiting around for her to die. He saw a young man of no more than 20 bopping along the other side of the street toward the Red Apple. He was the picture of health in his faded jeans and sleeveless Celtics jersey. But Ralph could see a death bag clinging to him like an oil slick, and a balloon string rising from the crown of his head that looked like a decaying drape pull in a haunted house. He saw no little bald doctors, but shortly after 5:30, he observed a startling shaft of purple light erupt from a manhole cover in the middle of Harris Avenue. It rose into the sky like a special effect in a Cecil B. DeMille Bible epic for perhaps 3 minutes, then simply winked out. He also saw a huge bird that looked like a prehistoric hawk go floating between the chimneys of the old dairy building around the corner on Howard Street, and alternating red and blue thermals twisting over Strawford Park in long, lazy ribbons. When soccer practice at Fairmount Grammar let out at 5:45, a dozen or so kids came swarming into the parking lot of the Red Apple, where they would buy tons of pre-supper candy and bales of trading cards. Football cards by this time of year, Ralph supposed. Two of them stopped to argue about something,
and their auras, one green and the other a vibrant shade of burnt orange, intensified, drew in, and began to gleam with rising spirals of scarlet thread.
"Look out!" Ralph shouted mentally at the boy within the orange envelope of light,
just a moment before Green Boy dropped his school books and socked the other in the mouth. The two of them grappled, spun around in a clumsy, aggressive dance, then tumbled to the sidewalk. A little circle of yelling, cheering kids formed around them. A purplish-red dome, like a thunderhead, began to build up around and above the fight. Ralph found this shape, which was circulating in a slow, counterclockwise movement, both terrible and beautiful, and he wondered what the aura above a full-scale military battle would look like. He decided that was a question to which he didn't really want an answer. Just as Orange Boy climbed on top of Green Boy and began to pummel him in earnest, Sue came out of the store and hollered at them to quit fighting in the damned parking lot. Orange Boy dismounted reluctantly. The combatants rose to their feet, looking at each other warily. Then Green Boy, trying to appear nonchalant, turned and went into the store. Only his quick glance back over his shoulder to make sure his opponent was not pursuing spoiled the effect. The spectators were either following Green Boy into the store for their post-practice supplies, or clustered around Orange Boy, congratulating him. Above them, unseen, that virulent red-purple toadstool was breaking up like a cloud bank before a strong wind. Pieces of it tattered, unraveled, and disappeared. The street is a carnival of energy, Ralph thought. The juice thrown off by those two boys during the 90 seconds they were mixing it up looked like enough to light Derry for a week. And if a person could tap the energy the watchers generated, the energy inside that mushroom cloud, you could probably light the whole state of Maine for a month. Can you imagine what it would be like to enter the world of auras in Times Square at 2 minutes to midnight on New Year's Eve? He couldn't, and didn't want to. He suspected he had glimpsed the leading edge of a force so huge and so vital that it made all the nuclear weapons created since 1945 seem about as powerful as a child's cap pistol fired into an empty peach can. Enough force to destroy the universe, perhaps. Or to create a new one. Ralph went upstairs, dumped a can of beans into one pot and a couple of hot dogs into another, and walked impatiently back and forth through the flat, snapping his fingers and occasionally running his fingers through his hair as he waited for this impromptu bachelor's supper to cook. The bone-deep weariness which had hung on him like invisible weights ever since midsummer was, for the time being at least, entirely gone. He felt filled with manic, antic energy, absolutely stuffed with it. He supposed this was why people liked Benzedrine and cocaine. Only he had an idea that this was a much better high, that when it departed it would not leave him feeling plundered and mistreated, more used than user. Ralph Roberts, unaware that the hair his fingers were combing through had grown thicker, and that threads of black were visible in it for the first time in 5 years, jive toured his apartment, walking on the balls of his feet, first humming and then singing an old rock and roll tune from the early 60s. "Hey, pretty baby, you can't sit down. You gotta slop, bop, slip, slop, flip, top, all about." The beans were bubbling in their pot, the hot dogs boiling in theirs. Only it looked to Ralph almost as if they were dancing in there, doing the Bristol stomp to the old Darvel's tune, still singing at the top of his lungs, "When you hear the hippie with the backbeat, you can't sit down." Ralph cut the hot dogs into the beans, dumped in half a pint of ketchup, added some chili sauce, then stirred everything vigorously together and headed for the door. He carried his supper still in the pot in one hand. He ran down the stairs as nimbly as a kid who's running late on the first day of school. He hooked a baggy old cardigan sweater, McGovern's, but what the hell, out of the front hall closet and then went back out on the porch. The auras were gone, but Ralph wasn't dismayed. For the time being, he was more interested in the smell of food. He couldn't remember the last time he'd felt as flat-out hungry as he did at that moment. He sat on the top step with his long thighs and bony knees sticking out on either side of him, looking decidedly Ichabod Crane-ish, and began to eat.
The first few bites burned his lips and tongue, but instead of being deterred, Ralph ate faster, almost gobbling. He paused with half the pot of beans and Franks consumed. The animal in his stomach hadn't gone back to sleep, not yet, but it had been pacified a bit. Ralph belched unselfconsciously and looked out at Harris Avenue with a feeling of contentment he hadn't known in years. Under the current circumstances, that feeling made no sense at all, but that didn't change it in the slightest. When was the last time he had felt this good? Maybe not since the morning he had awakened in that barn somewhere between Derry, Maine, and Poughkeepsie, New York, amazed by the conflicting rays of light, thousands of them, it had seemed, which crisscrossed the warm, sweet-smelling place where he lay. Or maybe never. Yes, or maybe never. He spied Mrs. Perrine coming up the street, probably returning from a safe place, the combination soup kitchen and homeless shelter down by the canal. Ralph once again found himself fascinated by her strange gliding walk, which she achieved without the aid of a cane and seemingly without any side-to-side movement of her hips. Her hair, still more black than gray, was now held, or perhaps subdued was the word, by the hairnet she wore on the serving line. Thick support hose the color of cotton candy rose from her spotless white nurse's shoes. Not that Ralph could see much of either them or the legs they covered. This evening, Mrs. Perrine wore a man's wool overcoat, and the hem came almost to her ankles. She seemed to depend almost entirely on her upper legs to move her along, a sign of some chronic back problem, Ralph guessed. And this mode of locomotion, coupled with the overcoat, gave Esther Perrine a somewhat surreal aspect as she approached. She looked like the Black Queen on a chessboard, a piece that was either being guided by an invisible hand or moving all by itself. As she neared the place where Ralph sat, still wearing the ripped shirt and now eating his supper directly from the pot in the bargain, the auras began to steal back into the world again. The streetlights had already come on, and now Ralph saw delicate lavender arcs hung over each. He could also see a red haze hovering above some roofs, a yellow haze above others, a pale cerise above still others. In the east, where night was now gathering itself, the horizon flocked with dim green speckles. Closer to hand, he watched as Mrs. Perrine's aura sprang to life around her, that firm gray that reminded him of a West Point cadet's uniform. A few darker spots, like phantom buttons, shimmered above her bosom. Ralph assumed there was a bosom hidden somewhere beneath the overcoat. He was not sure, but thought these might be signs of impending ill health. "Good evening, Mrs. Perrine," he said politely, and watched as the words rose in front of his eyes in snowflake shapes. She gave him a penetrating glance, flicking her eyes up and down, seeming to simultaneously sum him up and dismiss him in a single look. "I see you're still wearing that same shirt, Roberts," she said. What she didn't say, but what Ralph was sure she was thinking, was, "I also see you sitting there and eating beans right out of a pot, like some ragged street person who never learned any better. And I have a way of remembering what I see, Roberts." "So I am," Ralph said. I guess I forgot to change it." "Humph," said Mrs. Perrine, and now he thought it was his underwear she was considering. "When was the last time it occurred to you to change that? I shudder to think, Roberts." "Lovely evening, isn't it, Mrs. Perrine?" Another of those quick, bird-like glances, this time up at the sky, then back to Ralph. "It's going to turn cold." "Do you think so?" "Oh, yes. Indian summer's over. My back isn't good for much besides weather forecasting these days. But at that it does very well." She paused. "I believe that's Bill McGovern's sweater." "I guess it is," Ralph agreed, wondering if she would ask him next if Bill knew he had it. He wouldn't have put it past her. Instead, she told him to button it up. "You don't want to be a candidate for pneumonia, do you?" she asked, and the tucked set of her mouth added, "as well as for the nut house." "Absolutely not," Ralph said. He set the pot aside, reached for the sweater buttons, then stopped. He was still wearing a quilted stove glove on his left hand. He hadn't noticed it until now. "It will be easier if you take that off," Mrs. Perrine said. There might have been the faintest gleam in her eyes. I suppose so, Ralph said humbly. He shook off the glove and buttoned McGovern's sweater.
My offer holds good, Roberts.
Beg your pardon?
My offer to mend your shirt, if you can bring yourself to part with it for a day or so, that is.
She paused.
You do have another shirt, I assume. One you could wear while I mend the one you have on?
Oh, yes, Ralph said. You bet. Quite a few of them.
Choosing among them each day must be challenging for you. There's bean juice on your chin, Roberts.
With this pronouncement, Mrs. Perrine's eyes flicked forward, and she began to march once more. What Ralph did then, he did with no forethought or understanding. It was as instinctive as the chopping gesture he had made earlier to scare Dock Number 3 away from Rosalie. He raised the hand which had been wearing the thermal glove and curled it into a tube around his mouth. Then he inhaled sharply, producing a faint, whispery whistle. The results were amazing. A pencil of gray light poked out of Mrs. Perrine's aura like the quill of a porcupine. It lengthened rapidly, angling backward as the lady herself moved forward, until it had crossed the leaf-littered lawn and darted into the tube formed by Ralph's curled fingers. He felt it enter him as he inhaled, and it was like swallowing pure energy. He suddenly felt lit up like a neon sign or the marquee of a big city movie theater. An explosive sense of force, a feeling of pow, ran through his chest and stomach, then raced down his legs all the way to the tips of his toes. At the same time, it rocketed upward into his head, threatening to blow off the top of his skull as if it were the thin concrete roof of a missile silo. He could see rays of light, as gray as electrified fog, smoking out from between his fingers. A terrible, joyous sense of power lit up his thoughts, but only for a moment. It was followed by shame and amazed horror.
What are you doing, Ralph? Whatever that stuff is, it doesn't belong to you. Would you reach into a purse and take some of her money while she wasn't looking?
He felt his face flush. He lowered his cupped hand and shut his mouth. As his lips and teeth came together, he clearly heard, and actually felt, something crunch crisply inside. It was the sound you heard when you were chomping off a bit of fresh rhubarb. Mrs. Perrine stopped, and Ralph watched apprehensively as she made a half-turn and looked out at Harris Avenue.
I didn't mean to, he thought at her. Honest, I didn't, Mrs. P. I'm still learning my way around this thing.
Roberts?
Yes?
Did you hear something? It sounded almost like a gunshot.
Ralph could feel his ears throbbing with hot blood as he shook his head.
No, but my ears aren't what they... Probably just a backfire over on Kansas Street, she said, dismissing his weak sister excuses out of hand. It made my heart miss a beat, though, I can tell you.
She started off again in her odd, gliding, chess queen walk, then stopped once more and looked back at him. Her aura had begun to fade out of Ralph's view, but he had no trouble seeing her eyes. They were as sharp as a kestrel's.
You look different, Roberts, she said. Younger, somehow.
Ralph, who had expected something else.
Give me back what you stole, Roberts, and right this minute,
for instance, could only flounder.
Do you think that's very... I mean to say, thank you.
She flapped an impatient, oh, shut up, hand at him.
Probably the light. I advise you not to dribble on that sweater, Roberts. My impression of Mr. McGovern is that he is a man who takes care of his things.
He should have taken better care of his hat, Ralph said. Those bright eyes, which had begun once more to shift away from him, shifted back.
I beg your pardon?
His Panama, Ralph said. He lost it somewhere. Mrs. Perrine held this up to the light of her intellect for a moment, then cast it aside with another, humph.
Go inside, Roberts. If you stay out here much longer, you'll catch your death of cold.
And then she slid upon her way, not visibly the worse for wear as a result of Ralph's thoughtless act of thievery.
Thievery? I'm pretty sure that's the wrong word, Ralph. What you did just now was a lot closer to...
Vampirism? Ralph said bleakly. He put the pot of beans aside and began to slowly rub his hands together. He felt ashamed, guilty, and all but exploding with energy.
You stole some of her life force instead of her blood. But a vampire is a vampire, Ralph.
Yes, indeed. And it suddenly occurred to Ralph that this must not have been the first time he had done such a thing.
You look different, Roberts. Younger, somehow.
That was what Mrs. Perrine had said tonight. But people had been making similar comments to him ever since the end of the summer, hadn't they? The main reason his friends hadn't hectored him into going to the doctor was because he didn't look like anything was wrong with him. He complained of insomnia, but he apparently looked like the picture of health.
I guess that honeycomb must have really turned the trick, Johnny Lydecker had said just before the two of them had left the library on Sunday, back in the Iron Age that felt like now.
And when Ralph had asked him what he was talking about,
Lydecker had said he was talking about Ralph's insomnia. You'll look a gajillion times better than on the day I first met you.
And Lydecker hadn't been the only one. Ralph had been more or less dragging himself through the days, feeling folded, spindled, and mutilated. But people kept telling him how good he looked, how refreshed he looked, how young he looked.
Helen, McGovern, even Faye Chapin had said something a week or two ago, although Ralph couldn't remember exactly what.
Sure I do, he said in a low, dismayed voice. He asked me if I was using wrinkle cream. Wrinkle cream, for God's sake? Had he been stealing from the life force of others even back then? Stealing without even knowing it? I must have been, he said in that same low voice. Dear Jesus, I'm a vampire. But was that the right word, he wondered suddenly. Wasn't it at least possible that in the world of auras, a life stealer was called a centurion? Ed's pallid, frantic face rose before him, like a ghost which returns to accuse its murderer. And Ralph, suddenly terrified, wrapped his arms around his knees and lowered his head to rest upon them.